Get used to the mantra, all gas, no brake.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Turn on the Jets podcast. I'm your host, Will Parkinson, and you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube at WillPaul11, or my full name, Will Parkinson, for our YouTube channel. This is going to be our first live video segment of the podcast. Going forward, we're going to be having guests on both video and audio. So be on the lookout for that. And this will be in the in the podcast section as well. So no need to worry if you're just an audio listener. We want to get over a couple of things here. We have an exciting podcast for you today. Connie Carberg's coming on the show. We have a long conversation with her. She's actually the first female scout in the history of the NFL. She also is the first Jets scout, obviously female scout as well. She's still, to this day, the only female scout to ever make a draft pick at the NFL draft. She drafted in 1976, and then is famous for scouting Mark Gastineau, one of the best Jets of all time. So stay on the lookout for that. It's a really insightful conversation. She's a great, a great listen. So be on the lookout for that. Just want to get in a couple of things here. Nothing too crazy in Jets land this week. Basically, all is going to be rumored right now is going to be the quarterback trades and guys either potentially getting franchised or being moved on because the salary cap decreased. So Corey Linsley is one guy that's a Jets target. Him and the Packers seem to be far apart on an agreement as of now, and he's somebody the Jets should absolutely be targeting. He's run the LaFleur Shanahan system, obviously, in Green Bay. He's an all-pro level player. And would also be able to move Connor McGovern over to guard. Not Conor McGregor, although he'd probably be a much better center. Conor McGovern moving over to guard, then you pursue a guy either in the draft or you target a guy like Joe Tooney or Brandon Scherff to replace Alex Lewis / Greg Van Rotten at the other guard position. And now you've got an offensive line of Becton, an all-pro level player in Scherff or Tooney. You've got Linsley, an all-pro level player, McGovern, who would be an above-average right guard. And then you either go with George Fant, however you want to go, pronounce his name, and then or you draft somebody right tackle. So there is a ton of options, and it's a guy that the Jets need to go after. There should be legitimate interest there. And then, you look at Russell Wilson and Deshaun Watson, both have either requested a trade or are looking to potentially be moved on. I'm not so sure I buy into the Russell Wilson wants to leave Seattle conversation. I know he disagreed a lot with Brian Schottenheimer over the last couple of years, specifically last year, walking out of a meeting, it's being reported today. Disagreed, obviously, on a lot of running on first and second down, a lot of not letting Russ cook. But at the same time, you look at him and he did not play well down the stretch. He's an elite level player. He's a top five, top six quarterback. I have him more in the 4 to 5 range. Going to his age 33 season, still very much in his prime. You look at Tom Brady, Rodgers, Brees, these guys play well, played well in their late 30s and 40s. So don't expect any different from Russ. And he'd be a great addition to the Jets. I just don't see that happening. He put out a list today that if he were to move on, it'd be teams like the Saints, Bears, Raiders, and Dolphins, maybe more win-ready now teams. Although, I got to be honest with you, I'm not sure how you're trading for Russell Wilson if you're the Bears picking at 20. You're the Saints at 28 with zero cap space. I mean, they're $92 million over the cap, so I don't see that happening. Team like the Dolphins maybe, but there doesn't seem to be, the Dolphins have said we're not sure there yet. And then the Raiders make a lot of sense. Again, I'm not sure how that's getting done unless you're moving Carr and multiple picks and these things. I don't see Russ. I'd put it maybe 10% Russ gets moved. The Jets would have a lot of leverage if he does get moved with Deshaun, though, because if you're moving Russell Wilson for a bottom of the first round pick and additional assets, but the Jets have the number two pick. The number two pick is incredibly valuable. We've talked about this before. As a scale of 3,000, possible points a pick could be worth on the, NFL draft value scale. The Jets have the second pick is the second most valuable, obviously, at 2,600 points. Trevor Lawrence is going to go one. We're not buying into the Zach Wilson hype. That's a lot of teams trying to drive Zach Wilson up their draft board so they can get a guy to potentially fall like a Fields, Lance, or if you're, mid-first round, Mac Jones. And then you look at, if you're going to do that, the Jets can give up less and less for Deshaun Watson. And maybe it's two first-round picks and a player because you're giving up number two, and the Texans could go after a Wilson. I don't think the Texans would want at two. They were going to want Fields. I don't know that Justin Fields is going to want to go to the same situation Deshaun Watson was just in, saying that they share the same marketing coordinator here in New York and agency. to share Quincy Avery as a quarterback coach. Don't see that happening. So if the Texans are going to make this deal happen, it's been reported that the Texans want to make sure that Deshaun will go to the Jets because they know they can get the best value out of him. So be on the lookout for that. We'll keep you updated as much as we can. But again, Deshaun met with David Culley today. No progress. He does not want to be there. He's putting his feet into the ground. He's digging his heels, and he's not playing for the Houston Texans ever again. Whether he gets moved before the season, you know, time will only tell. But I think maybe 60% he gets traded, 65%. I still think there's a chance he comes back. And, you know, there's always – you can always throw more money or try to figure out a situation. But the Jets should be favorites if Deshaun gets moved. I've said this before. Yes, Miami's a possibility. Carolina's also a possibility. Does Miami want to move on from Tua a year after drafting him in the top five? He wasn't great last year. I think he was a big-time QB manager. Obviously, they had the relief pitcher aspect of Fitzpatrick and, you know, all that stuff. But, again, do you want to bail on a guy after 1 year when you were a game away from the playoffs? Your Carolina's perspective, they want a quarterback. I think they're actually better off drafting a guy because they have such a young core around him. They could build such a young core around that player. But again, if you could get Deshaun Watson, you do it, right? It depends on the price. But the Jets are in the perfect situation. I'm the biggest Sam Darnold fan there is. I can understand and acknowledge Deshaun Watson would be incredible for the Jets. But again, if the price gets exorbitant, it's 4 or 5 ones, you don't do it. But having that number two pick, they have the ability to build around Deshaun. They have the ability to surround him with talent and also, you know, long-term flexibility on the cap number. Because of the contract that he's on, it's an extension, but Houston's already paid a lot of the guaranteed money and bonuses, and the Jets will be able to have a reasonable cap number, I think about over $10 million this year from a base cap perspective. So, again, on lookout for that. On lookout for guys like Corey Linsley, potentially not going back to Green Bay, franchise tag, deadline's coming up here. So you're going to see, I predict the Jets are going to franchise tag Marcus May, which I think is a smart move at that $10 million a year range. Just for next year, they can tag him twice at a reasonable number, and he could be going into his age 30 season before the Jets ever have to give him a long-term deal. Again, I'd like to extend Marcus May 3 or 4 year deal at a reasonable $8 to $9 million average annual value deal. But if you can tag him and not lock yourself up long-term, you do it. And then Tooney, Sheriff, Allen Robinson, guys like that, Kenny Galladay, Godwin, can be franchise tagged, so be on the lookout for that as well.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
All right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm here with Connie Carberg, a.k.a. Girl Scout. She was the first female scout in the NFL and worked with the Jets, famously scouting Mark Gastineau. So, Connie, welcome. How's everything going?
Everything's going great, Will, and it's a pleasure to be on with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. And you know, people aren't familiar with Connie, I highly suggest you go and kind of check her out on Twitter at Connie Scouts, or check out, you know, the book on her. And there's an NFL Network film special about her as well. You know, all that's on her Twitter page and website. And I think it's some really interesting stuff that we'll kind of get into here. So, Connie, if you could kind of just walk us through a little bit of your background. You know, how you kind of got into scouting and your passion for the Jets.
Sure. It's That's something I love to talk about. So yeah, it all started just as I said, growing up, just being a tomboy and playing all different sports. But back then, girls didn't play football. That just wasn't one of the sports that you played. You know, you could play baseball and softball and swim and basketball and all that stuff, but not football. But so I didn't understand the sport that well. And then my dad, Dr. Calvin Nicholas, and my uncle, Dr. James Nicholas, who's the orthopedist, my dad was the internist, they became the two team doctors with the Titans, of course, who became the Jets. Harry Wismer was the owner at that time. And so I was like 13 years old then, and my whole life changed. I decided to start learning about it, met the players, which always makes a difference when you meet some players and you get to know them. And the world back then was very, very casual and low key. And, you know, the players back then, you know, this is, as I said, this was in 64, 63 when they started. Players all had to have off-season jobs and all that kind of stuff. But during my teen years, there was not much. It was one game on TV with Keith Jackson doing it. And there was Street and Smith. And then there was the Bob Hope. You probably never heard of him. Well, he's too.
I've heard of him, but it was slightly before my time.
So he used to have a special, and then he would have the All-American team come on. And that's the way you kind of try to do so. And I would watch all this. And for when I was about 15, 16, I started to do my own mock drafts. And I don't even know what made me do it, but that's how I started. And as I said, the players were always over at the house. My dad, being the doctor, he had the office connected to the house. And so the players, whenever they'd be examined, and coaches would be over there all the time. And I had a chance that we were all back in those days, as I said, it was very low key, and everybody was at each other's house back. This was the beginning towards, as we started to go in the 60s, became the Super Bowl team. And whether it was Emerson Boozer and Ralph Baker and you know, all these different guys that we had on the team, we would go to each other's houses as well. So I just kind of grew up around that. And Walt Michaels, who became a head coach for the Jets at that time, was the defensive coordinator, which he was in the Super Bowl. And he was a good friend of my dad's, and he would come over and he would teach me a lot as we watched the college game. I remember watching John Riggins when he was in college with him and stuff like that. So we would talk about everything. And I also had a teacher in high school that was my earth science teacher, and I would stay after school and he would teach because he was also a football coach. So I try to learn, you know, as much as I could. And from there, after I got done with high school, of course, the Jets won the Super Bowl my senior year in high school.
That's a pretty good, I wish, if they win a Super Bowl in my lifetime, I'll be over the moon. So I can't imagine how that felt.
It was awesome. You know, before that, people would say, oh, what's wrong with your Jets? Just like they do now, right? But all of a sudden, everything came together and we won the Super Bowl. And it was just exciting. I got to go to the game. And all that. In fact, in the offseason, the Jets would have a basketball team. Now you probably wouldn't be allowed because with insurance purpose liability.
After everyone watched the A-Rod and Aaron Boone thing that happened like 20 years ago at the Yankees, I'm not sure anyone's going to be playing basketball anytime soon.
Isn't it fine? Amazing. I know. It's exactly. So they would all be playing. They would make like an extra $50, you know, to play in the basketball. So as I said, all those things came together. And I went to girls college and I played basketball. They didn't have girls scholarships at that time even. But there was something missing. And I decided to transfer to The Ohio State University. And that was really
the Ohio State. The Ohio State.
So Woody Hayes was the legend, just like, you know, say a Nick Saban is now, and everybody knew who he was and he was the head coach. And so I would go to the games and stuff. But one day I went over to the student union where I knew the football team ate. And I waited until Coach Hayes came out, and he had a book also called You Win With People. And so when he came out, I introduced myself, told him my history and my dad and all that kind of stuff and my passion for football and how much I loved it, all that stuff. And he said, well, right now there isn't anything for females per se, but I want you to come over to the stadium and we'll meet, which I did. And from there, he said, don't give up your passion. Keep going at it. You don't know what it might develop into. Because at that time, I thought, well, okay, when I graduate, I will go ahead and teach school, and then I will coach girls sports afterwards. That's basically what was in my mind. Well, I would go to all the games. I would talk to scouts that came to visit. I went to every practice. Even if it was closed, he let me go to pray. He was unbelievable to me. And I went there. And of course, my life with the Jets still was during the summer training camp at Hofstra University. And I would be there all the time when I wasn't coaching a swim team during the summer. So it all kind of just led. And one day my father had a 50th birthday party. And we invited a lot of people. And we invited a couple of Jets. And the head coach was there, Charlie Winter. And he happened to be Weeb Eubanks' son-in-law. And he was a head coach. I said, and I just kind of like to talk to people. So I table hopped and sat down with him.
You went for it. You're like, why not? What do I have to lose?
I had no idea. I wish I could say I knew what I was doing, but I didn't. And we started talking, and he said, you know, you love football so much. We're building a brand new complex at Hofstra University on Long Island in Hempstead. And right, that's where they were practicing at this time. They had moved from Peekskill. He said, would you consider working? And I said, are you kidding me? I don't care about anything else.
I'll gladly.
So that's how I got to work for them. They built this brand in 1974, right after I graduated. And at first I was the only girl in the entire place with the coaches, the trainers, the players, everything. Eventually they added more secretaries, but I was a scouting secretary at that time, along with being the receptionist, along with doing everything else. And that's how it all began. But as I said, back then it was really a very relaxed thing. You could, if somebody called on the phone and said, oh man, I really like this player, I just would go through the doors towards the back and I would yell girl back and go back to the locker room. And I would say, David Knight or whoever, Randy Rasmussen, whoever it might be, there's somebody that's a real fan of yours. When you get done getting dressed, would you come up and talk to them on the phone? And they would say, sure.
And that's a very different now. It's very, yes. Very, very different. Now you have to tweet at somebody or hope they'll respond to you after the game.
Yes, it was a really, as I said, very relaxed. And that's where my life began in 1974, working for the Jets at that time. Okay. So after I started that, I was doing secretarial work, even though I didn't know how to be a secretary. I had no idea how to type or do anything, but they saw how much I knew football and loved it. And so in the very first draft, which was 1975 that I did, and back, would you believe their draft was, this is kind of, it was back in the end of January, they did the draft. And so it was right after the season. And then we had the Senior Bowl and the Hula Bowl and a Japan Bowl. And then you went right into the draft. It was 17 rounds. So
a lot of room for error.
It's amazing. Isn't that something? Now we only have 7 rounds. It was 17 back there. So I did that. And when they got to the 17th round, my boss, Mike Hollaback, who was director of player personnel, said, kind of, we want you to make the last pick. So I did. I'm still to this day the only girl that's actually made a draft selection, which I, as I said, I was shocked to do it.
It's pretty cool.
It is. And I said, because I was always the one that would sit and then call into New York, you know, the New York Jets select, and then whoever it was. And draft day was, as I said, there's no day like draft day. It's so exciting. And oh my gosh,
I still think that's one of the most exciting parts of football in general in the NFL, is just the excitement and the promise and expectation. And
it is
just so much up in the air. You've you could be looking at the next Tom Brady. You could be looking at the next guy who doesn't even make the roster. You've no idea. It's so exciting.
None. And in fact, I think I'm trying to remember at that time when we drafted, I think that 75, Richard Wood and a few other, and I think they, what was it? I can't remember if it was the USFL or the World Football League. They went there instead. So we didn't even get our first picks. And really the only pick that really made it big that year was Joe Fields. He was a 14th round pick as our center, and he was a center for a long time. So I made Mike Bartosik of Ohio State. As I said, he didn't make it, but he wasn't one of the first to be cut. So I always felt good about that. So that's how it all began. And then from there, Al Ward became the general manager, who just passed away. I don't know. Today, I woke up and Jim Irsay from the Colts had put on Twitter about the passing, which I hadn't seen. It was last month that Mr. Ward, and I had talked with him when we were doing our book, and he was 91 when I spoke with him. He passed away at 93, and he was a general manager. And he's the one, though, that said afterwards, we were all doing, working on game plans eating dinner, and he said, Connie, I want you to become a scout for us. And I was like, whoa, okay, this is 1976.
That's incredible.
It was. And he had seen me and known what I had done. I used to go to, you know, watch practices every day and all that kind of stuff. So that's how it all began, being a scout in 1976, and then all the way through. And then we get to the, of course, the story about Gastineau.
I was going to say, that's the, like, I mean, the guy was an incredible defense, and he's still probably one of the, I don't know, unbiasedly, maybe one of the top five or six Jets players of all time. And it's, we're 30 years later, and it's like, it hasn't changed. I don't know that I love her probably. I mean, I still think that the Michael Strahan is a bit of a, it's a tough record breaker there, but no, I mean, he was an incredible player, and obviously you can talk more about it, but I mean, somebody that is an absolute legend, obviously, with the Jets and the sack exchange and the whole nine yards.
Yeah, and it was kind of neat because we had built the sack exchange. You know, we had built with the one draft Klecko, who was a truck driver and this and that, and he was other things. And so we got him, and then we got Larry Falk, who became Abdul Salam. And then the year that what happened was in so as I said, we were starting to build the team, and then Walt Michaels became the head coach, you know, in 78. And since I grew up with him, was that a blessing. And he was always so good to me and asked, you know, opinion and anything that I could find out to help him. You know, it was a pleasure to work for him. So when that happened, we came to the final draft, and my original boss had left, Mike Holodeck, to go to the Houston Oilers, they were called at that time. And he had done two, if you check out the drafts from 76 and 77, those were Mike Holodeck's drafts, and they were unbeatable and the real basis. You can't, all the guys of our 80s team that was so good. So after that happened, when I'm trying to remember, okay, so after we were, oh, let's see how we had the draft in 78, and then 79 came up, and we're getting ready to do the Senior Bowl, and they always pick coaches like they did this year. And I don't know if we've ever done it since 79. I wish we would, because boy, do you have an advantage when you
get a great experience. You can scout. It's, you know, it's not even like a pro day. It's obviously you get to watch these guys on pads up close and see how they take coaching, see how they're able to interact with criticism or positive energy. You can get such a feel for them. Unlike, it's, I don't know, I think that's why part of the Senior Bowl for me, at least personally, is obviously you don't want to overreact to things that happen because it's a week and whatever, but at the same time, watching somebody practice day in, day out with pressure on them, with coaches, they interact, you can really get a feel for somebody like you can at a pro day or the combine.
No. And it's, this one is, it was to this day, it is such a great thing. And so I went, all of a sudden Mike Stensrud, who was a defensive lineman who played in the NFL and everything, he got hurt in an accident. I can't remember if it was a, you know, ski or motorbike or whatever, but he got hurt. And I was asked by my boss, who was on the road along with Walt, to go find a replacement. Now you have to remember, back then there were no such thing as, we were just starting computers, but they hadn't come into college except for the Dallas Cowboys. They were way ahead of the game, but we didn't have that. You know, you didn't have all the tapes, you didn't have YouTube, you didn't have all these different things that you can find out about players like you can now. So I found whatever tapes, I looked at all their different reports, and they were about five guys that weren't scheduled to be first or second round picks because they were already in the Senior Bowl. And most of these other guys were rounds 4 to 7 probably. So I looked through them, narrowed it down to five guys. And then I said, well, I'm going to call them, because I'm a firm believer in talking to people. And so I did, I called each one. Most of the guys were like, well, all right, I don't know if I'm in shape. When do I have to go? How long is it when you go there? What are they expecting me to do? Blah, blah, blah. One guy that I called was, I mean, I'm ready. Just put me on the next flight. I'm in shape. This is all I want to do in my life. And he was so full of enthusiasm and pumped, which I really like. So after I hung up that phone with him, I went back and looked at the reports. And he was the one, even though he was from East Central Oklahoma, which is a small school, and back then you didn't look at small schools that much, we didn't have as much information, but he, you know, he ran a 4.55 at, you know, at 280 pounds. And so
still impressive to this day. The game's even as fast as the game is now. The game was slower then, and like to run sub 4.6 it is at the end at 280 just it's
amazing.
A lot.
So I said, well, I'm gonna take him. So I told my boss and I told Walt, and I said, let's go with him. So he went down to the Senior Bowl. And from all the things that I heard, you know, he just, man, he tore it up in practice. I talked to Dan Sikanovich, who became his defensive line coach at the Jets. But he told, you know, he said he was unbelievable there. And then he became the most valuable player for the North team on defense. And the South team, the most valuable player on defense was Marty Lyons. So the Jets that year, what a great thing. The first round, we take Marty Lyons. In the second round, we get Mark Gastineau, and there's half of the sack exchange right there.
Talk about hitting on two picks. I've met Marty a couple of times when I like used to be as a kid around the team, and like it's a heck of a first two picks to have and be able to hit on two guys that
isn't it? And like from two different worlds, you got a guy that had been so well known in Marty, you know, from University of Alabama. And made a big play and a big stoppage in that one game and everything. So he was well known. And then you had Mark, who really wasn't known at all. And so, as I said, now they were now able to team up with Abdul Salam and Joe Klecko. So what a, as I said, but that was like the biggest thing. And Mark and I have, you know, stayed friends for over 45 years. And he's, you know, he's been great. He's doing so well. You know, there were all the different things that went on, you know, with and stuff during his playing days. But boy, what a player. And just so full of enthusiasm. His sack dance, you know, he said he did that when he was at East Central Oklahoma. And that's just the way he is. He was just like a big kid. And that's what I loved about him was his passion. And so he became, as I said, so good. And he's doing great. Now he went through about right now with colon cancer, but he's clean and doing well. And he sang in church choir. He and his wife, he's got a great wife. So everything turned out really, really well. But back then, so now we did that and we got all those guys together. And from there, I was still there for another year. And then I met my husband and we had a chance to go down to Florida with a big job. And he left it up to me to make the decision. And I left the Jets, which was a huge decision.
Yeah, but you know what? It's all about the amount of value you created. Like at the end of the day, it's, you know, that's a pretty good legacy to leave. You know, that's some pretty good draft classes to be able to leave. And as a scout, like that's, like you mentioned, draft day, you take the most pride in because it's where you get to shine. And it's about the scouts. It's about the general manager. It's about how you can identify talent.
And it's so neat because, you know, as I said, with that draft, whether it was Marvin Powell, you know, and Wesley Walker and Kevin Long and Scotty Durking and Dan Alexander. I mean, those were all, and I could go on, Matt Robinson and all those guys. And the year before, as I said, we did really well with Schaefer Suggs and Richard Todd and Abdul and Klecko. And so those 2 years were totally amazing. Then we picked up a few guys like a Bobby Jackson in 78 and, you know, other guys that just came through and also a great free agent in Brucey Harper. And that one was done because Walt Michaels' son went to school with him at Kutztown State. And he said, why don't you just give him a tryout? And Brucey became his great.
Even in football, in the NFL, it's all about who you know and the connections you made. But no, I think it's an incredible kind of journey, and obviously, you know, there's the book and all that type of stuff, and it's definitely something that I think people should you know, kind of take a look at more in depth if, you know, if they, you know, want to learn more and stuff like that. And, you know, kind of fast forwarding to like present day, and how do you kind of go about do you still go and watch film on these guys, and how do you kind of get excited for draft day and, you know, 2020 and 2021?
Well, this was a kind of a crazy year with the pandemic and people opted out and all that kind of stuff. And it was some teams played 5 games and some played 12 and some didn't play at all. But normally, you know, and I still do, I sit from, you know, 9 a.m. watching all the, you know, college game day. And then I watch all the games that I can all day long till midnight. I watch all those games on the West Coast too.
At 12 after dark.
That's it. And so I watched all them. And then I kind of just keep notes there until, and of course, now you have YouTube and you have other things, other ways to look at the players and go back, and everybody has all these different things. And you go, but I tell you, you go around in circles. It's a different game now than it was. You know, back then you had your basic 4-3 or 3-4 in blitz, but you didn't have, you know, there was nothing, people didn't move in motion or exotic different things. And a lot of guys that are making it now as, say, situational players and specialists wouldn't have made it back then because they didn't, everybody played every down almost, you know, you didn't tap out, come out for a play. I can't imagine
situational, like a third down pass rusher or a third down.
No,
somebody that's a nickel corner and things like that.
No, I can't imagine, you know, Klecko tapping out or Mark tapping out or Greg Buttle or any of those guys tapping out. They just didn't, you know, it was just a different type of game in the way that they played. So when I watch now and then quarterbacks, the whole game has changed. In the old days, up until the past 3 or 4 years, the number one question was, how does he stand in the pocket? Can he take a hit in the pocket? You know, can he stand, can he stay there and scan the field, you know, with progressions? And you want him to be, of course, accuracy is important no matter now or then, but it was more important back then is how did he stand tall? Did he, his motion overhand, you wanted that, man, you never wanted somebody to throw sidearm or these off platform as they call it now. But now the first question they ask is, can he extend the play? So a guy like Mac Jones, who would have been very ideal 8 years ago, 10 years ago, or more, whatever. Now he gets pushed back because it doesn't have that mobility. And guys that are much more mobile that we would say, wait a minute, no, he can't make it in the NFL because he's not going to stay in the pocket. But the NFL has become more, in my opinion, like the college game and taken that on versus the way that it used to be.
Yeah, no, I think that's a big reason why a lot of guys, you look at part of the reason the excitement around a Justin Fields or Zach Wilson, and even, you know, in my opinion, the reason Sam is still so valuable is because they're able to make those off-platform throws and throw outside of the numbers. They can make all the throws from an arm strength perspective, but it's their ability to buy themselves time and create, whereas Mac Jones might not do that as well, but his accuracy, obviously, as much as the offense is incredibly talented at Alabama, you know, all-time great offense, but you got to still be able to make the plays and make the decisions. And in terms of those guys, like who, if the Jets don't run it back with Sam and either, you know, draft somebody at 2 or trade down, is there somebody that stands out to you that you like more so than the other quarterbacks?
I got to, as I said, I've always been a big Sam Darnold fan from the time that he was at USC. And, you know, as I said, when his first year and he was third and he had 31 touchdowns and 9 interceptions, the second year went to 26-13, but he was, you know, he just caught your eye and in everything that he did. And he didn't even start playing quarterback till he was a junior in high school because he was a linebacker. And then he got hurt and then he only played his senior year. So he really doesn't, he didn't have half the experience that a lot of these kids when they're starting really, really young. So, but I was a huge fan. I still am. As I said, I really feel, in my opinion, it really hurt when Josh McCown was no longer there as a stabilizing force in that first year. It really made such a difference on his last bunch of games and things like that. So the last 2 years, I think, and with injuries and the mono set him back. As far as the, I don't know what Joe Douglas is going to do. As I said, he's a great guy who keeps things completely. I love it because there's no leaks on the Jets and there's no way of knowing what they're going to do, which is he's terrific at that. And so I go back and forth, you know, I went to Ohio State. So then I look at Justin Fields and I love the fact that he's big and strong and you saw the hit that he took. And all that kind of stuff. And then came back and threw 6 touchdowns. And yet, people are worried about him holding the ball too long. Then you have Zach Wilson, who's now the kind of quarterback that, you know, I don't like to ever compare anybody to Mahomes. You just can't. He's in a class by himself. So, but Zach, and he's only had really one great year. So you're looking at him.
That always scares me a bit when guys kind of get elevated so high. They, you know, went from Zach Wilson might be a first round guy to Zach Wilson's a top 10. Now it's like they're getting all this floating out that he's better than Trevor Lawrence. And it's like, that always scares me, the overreaction of guys, where Justin Fields, at least to me, feels more like he's been in the conversation for the last 18 months, 2 years. Him and Trevor Lawrence have been in high school together. They competed. They were 1-2. In college, they were 1-2. And now it's like,
yeah.
I'm not saying Zach Wilson isn't good. I just, it scares me sometimes when guys get shot off the board from maybe there'd be a fourth, fifth round pick. Then all of a sudden they're a first round pick. Then now they're top 10. Maybe they go one. It's like, that scares me a little bit sometimes.
I mean, he looks really accurate. Zach, you know, Zach Wilson and everything. The only thing that scares me, he's already had a shoulder injury. And that's without the combine and the actual medicals and interviews that they're doing, and private workouts that you can't do. This is going to be a really tough draft for the NFL and for the different teams, because, you know, that really makes a huge difference. I remember there were a lot of guys that the Jets couldn't draft when I was there because they didn't pass their physicals. Or you saw the thing what happened with Jakai Polite a few years ago. We took him in the third round, and remember at the combine, this is not a secret, it was talked about
for the Rams.
They talked about how he just didn't have his interview, and they didn't, the attitude, and he came in overweight. Well, now we don't get a chance to see those things. And the pro days, you know, every school can be running it. They want their guy to be a little bit faster. They may be running it on Astro or grass, which is different. They may be, you know, in better places, indoors, outdoors conditions, versus everybody at the combine, you at least knew you had 350 people that you could kind of say, this is all legit. So that's why, of all years, I think this is really going to test scouting staffs of every team. And I don't envy it at all.
Yeah, no, I think it's one of these drafts that you're going to see a lot of big hits and guys that fall maybe the second, third, fourth round that make it and end up being Pro Bowl, all pro level players. And I think a lot of guys that could go and could creep up to top 15, top 20 picks that just based on lack of film, lack of, like you said, in-person time, interview time, that could end up being out of the league in 2 or 3 years. And I don't even, it's not like a indictment on some of these GMs and scouts. It's just, it's going to be more difficult than ever. You're watching more film virtually, you're interviewing guys virtually. It's difficult, you know, not having a big part of college football is the crowds, and having to play road games, going to Ohio State as a small Big Ten school, you're never going to win there because there's 110,000 people in the Horseshoe every weekend.
Yes.
You go to play Ohio State this year, there's nobody in this crowd. There's maybe 100, 200 people. And that factor of playing the road, just, it's not the same. And I think that people don't factor in as well.
No, I agree with you there too, because it does make a difference on pressure, how people react to pressure, the heart of a player. There's just so many. And now, again, scheme fits. So a guy that you may think is really a good player doesn't fit into the scheme that of the team that you're hoping he might go to, which is very different again than the old days. Basically everybody fit on everybody's team.
Yeah. You didn't, it wasn't so scheme specific. Whereas now, like, that's one of the reasons people are interested in Zach Wilson or Fields, or even in keeping Sam, which I've said before in the pod, and I know we've talked about, but I partially want to keep Sam, even if I didn't love him, because the scheme fits him so perfectly. A lot of bootlegs, a lot of getting out of the pocket, play action, quick one read throws where he can show all of his talent, which I think is incredibly important. And it QB friendly, going from a system that, in my opinion, Adam Gase's system was basically Peyton Manning developed it for himself and kind of took it from him and tried to fit, you know, guys that don't have the same skill set. You know, and then now you take Sam and you put a bunch of guys that are more reliable, in my opinion. You know, getting do stuff after the catch where, you know, Sam does have a big arm. And I think that we forget about it because year one, I remember being at that Broncos game, even opening night against the Lions, there's the Colts game. You look back at Green Bay, threw for 450 and 3 or 4 touchdowns. Houston, like, there are these games where you just go, this guy's incredible. And then, yes, I understand the New England game last year. And there's a couple games this year where you're like, your eyes roll. But I also think that the Shanahan system takes a lot of that stuff away and creates favorable matchups where it's not, Sam's not sitting there having to read 3-4 guys. He's, I'm going to be here, or I'm dumping it off. It's like quick. You're not going through 7 progressions. That's just my opinion from outside of all the stuff I know about the Shanahan offense, but I know you can talk maybe more about it.
No, as you said, I think you're right. And that's what is, I'm sure that's what they're all, what they're going over and what they're, you know, figuring out on him. But, you know, Sam is a hard worker. He loves the game, which are two very, very, very important things also. In it, you know, and it's dedicated. We know he's dedicated. He's not a guy that mouths off. He's not a guy that makes a lot of praise. He's in there. I mean, there was never a time that he said anything, you know, that could have been construed after all.
I don't know how he bit his tongue at the end. I think I would have snapped at one point and just lost it.
Yes, I know. Because, well, he's, and all season long, having somebody, you know, somebody say this, they're going to take this person. So, I mean, he had, whatever's going to happen, Sam's going to be okay. Whatever happens with him, that I'm always a big fan of his. We need a lot of things on the Jets, as obvious, because nobody even came close to making a Pro Bowl. Yeah. I mean, or even anyway. So we need so many. And then the guys, we had so many guys with hamstrings and injuries that, again, it made it really, really difficult. So,
I hope that injury thing is an Adam Gase thing. And I know it sounds crazy to blame him for injuries. And it's like, but it happened in Miami a lot. I looked back at a lot of the injury reports they had from week to week basis, and guys, it sounds horrible, but guys don't want to put their career on the line for injuries that if their team, they don't think is going anywhere, or a coach they're not bought into. And I think of guys like, yes, you know, Denzel Mims or people like that felt like they were hurt all year. And I don't blame Denzel at all, because it's like to go through two hamstrings. I've pulled my hamstrings before playing and it's tough, but you're not going to rush yourself back for a team that's you don't feel is going anywhere. And I think I'm hoping that Robert Saleh has such a buy-in from these guys, which I've been incredibly impressed from everything I've heard and all that type of stuff. But I'm hoping that the buy-in they have, it's like, this rolled ankle, which I would normally play, wouldn't play on, I want to play on because, like, this guy, I want to die on the field for this guy. And I think that's something that Rex had that he did really well, at least in the beginning. I think Herm Edwards was really good with it. I think Parcells, obviously, I think he's, my opinion, is the best Jets head coach GM. I mean, that staff he built in 98 is still the best Jets staff, in my opinion, I've ever seen. I mean, all those guys were multi-time NFL head coaches, everyone on the Jets staff, which I had a conversation the other day, you know, that was a big thing when they hired Saleh was, oh, he's going to bring Mike LaFleur, but he might get poached in 2 years. And I'm like, when's the last time somebody poached the Jets coordinator? Since 98. I mean, you look at that staff and Belichick and Charlie Weiss and Romeo Crennel and goes on and on. And it's like all these guys, I mean, they're still all coach, like Belichick's probably the greatest coach ever. And Parcells is one of them. And Romeo Crennel, that is an incredible defensive coordinator. And Charlie Weiss is a multi-time head coach at Notre Dame and Kansas and the Peyton and Texans, I believe. I hope that they address the needs, but also get such a buy-in. And I think they do miss the fans. I think the Jets fans make a huge impact from an NFL perspective. And these games last year, you look at that, maybe they're down 7 early. And instead of the fans kind of getting them up on a big play, it's like, dead silent there. It's like, oh,
I can't. You know, I know they make the sound for us, but we're watching it. But from what I understand, that they don't hear the same thing on the field. So I can't even imagine. It just has to feel like I give these guys a lot of credit, the players.
When things go bad like that, it's like there's no one to pick you up. And I watch it in other sports too. And it's like the bad teams are even worse because they don't even get the buy-in from the fans. It's just like,
no,
they're just getting punched in the teeth for 4 quarters.
Nope, there's no question. They do. Football really needs it. It really makes a big, big difference. I'm excited. You know, you never know how a coordinator is going to be as a head coach. We know that happens so often that they don't make it. But at least from what we can see, the players really, really respect Robert Saleh. The guy was a tight end in college. So he knows, he played tight ends. That means he knows the offensive side of the ball, even though he's been defense as coaching otherwise. So it means he played on that side. And then now he coached great and all the different people that really liked him. And as I said, he's brought in a wide variety of coaches. As from what I can see, of course, I'm very excited. I'm so happy they kept Grant Boyer on special teams again.
Miss Mike Westhoff, but
I know he was awesome. But now we got Leon Washington. I'm excited.
I love to get Leon Washington. He made my like all decade fan favorite as like a running back, and I think he's somebody that I like to see. Like there's been, as much as there's been a lot of down the last, especially the last 10 years. Like I think we forget sometimes there have been a lot of great players that have walked through the door and, you know, Florham Park or offshore or wherever, you know. So, and it's like Leon was one of those guys. He's a homegrown guy. He's,
yes.
His career is spent with the Jets. I know he's Seattle at the end, but he's excited.
Leon's always been a favorite. I was so excited when I saw that. I think that is just because we haven't done that a lot with our, you know, with former players. And, you know, Aaron Glenn went to Detroit now and everything.
I was hoping he was going to come along with Salah, but I understand he got his, you know,
Exactly. But I love seeing that when they bring in some of the guys. And we, as I said, we haven't, you know, done that much. So that was really, so I think Jet fans went crazy on Twitter. They were so excited to see Leon come and be working with Brant Boyer, who they already love too. So I think that's, a really good twosome to work together.
Yeah, no, I agree. And then I guess kind of we'll just transition to the last thing. And we've kind of been talking, if everyone's been following along, the quarter century team last 25 years of Jets football, and we did tight ends and fullbacks and talked about guys like, you know, Richie Anderson and Tony Richardson, and then
from
that perspective, Chris Baker and Dustin Keller are guys that really stood out
to me. I love Dustin.
Try not to get Kyle Brady too much flack. Ball completely, but that didn't work.
I know, but it's funny. Kyle Brady was Parcells used him really well as a blocker. If you remember how he would man, and he was unbelievable doing that. As far as coming, it's all how coaches know how to use certain players, and other coaches don't do it as well. You know, and sometimes fans forget. They always say, "Oh, we're such a losing team," but Herm Edwards took us to the playoffs 3 times since 2000. When you know, every time that Chad Pennington, who I dearly love. And if he had, you know, the poor guy, if he had had any kind of health, was unbelievable and the most accurate thrower and class act, and took us to the playoffs 3 times. Then we had Rex come in, and take us to two other games, you know, two other playoffs into the AFC Championship game and stuff. So during that whole decade, fans forget from 2000 through 2011, we were pretty darn good.
Yeah, I put out a thing. I was like between 98 and 2000. You know, end of 2010, I think we're in the playoffs like 6 or 7 times.
Yep.
6 times, they won the, you know, won the division, made 3 championship games. Like, that's why, like, when people always give me stuff, oh, why do you love the Jets so much? It's like, well, I grew up with it, but also my entire childhood from 4 to until I was a sophomore in high school, the Jets were good most of the time. They had some terrible years, obviously, everyone does, but it's been the last decade. Yep. I feel that's gonna have to change for some of the younger kids. But no, next week is gonna be doing defensive line. Is there any defensive linemen over the last, you know, 20-25 years that kind of stand out to you that were, you know, a favorite of yours?
Well, defensive line is that we haven't really, you know, since the Gaston Owens, since John Abraham, we really haven't had this a great pass rusher. I mean, Sean Ellis was a solid defensive lineman and did a really good job. And you know, I'm even stretching to think off the top of my head on a great defensive, lineman.
I don't know. There's a couple years of Chris Jenkins. There was John Abraham in the beginning, but there's been a lot of disappointment. I mean, Mo Wilkerson had a good start until
that was sad. That was sad. And Sheldon Richardson. Sheldon had a great first year, and he really looked like, I mean, we really thought we were going to be set with having these, you know, with Mo and with Sheldon Richardson,
Leonard Williams in the beginning. I love Leonard Williams by
security. Yes.
You know, of course, now he's, you know, all pro level player with the Giants, of course, but, you know,
don't forget he's ready to get a nice contract. And somehow, as I said, if you have a team with all guys that are going to be just coming up to their contract year, you know, you are more, I don't want to say like you're not always trying, but that gives you that added incentive to even do more than you ever did.
Contract year boost is definitely a real thing. The Giants got to be careful, because that number that, you know, Leonard Williams is at, it's, yes, he's very valuable and he's a good, you know, really good player in the run game and can get, you know, the 8 to 10 sacks. But if you franchise him at $20 million a year, that's a lot. And if you sign him to a long-term extension, you're kind of tying up probably between $16 and $18 million a year in a guy that's not going to be – he's not Aaron Donald and he's not J.J. Watt, you know, and these guys. So you got to be really careful with that, at least in my opinion. You don't want to –
And it's the hardest thing to – it's the hardest thing to know how people respond. Some people respond with money and they relax, like Mo did. And some people play even harder You give them all the money in the world. And you know, Patrick Mahomes is never going to not give everything in the whole wide world that he has. It's just the way people are built.
Disappointing with Le'Veon is that he like did after, I think earlier this year, that like after he got the money, he kind of let himself go a little bit in shape wise. And it's a full year of, playing football as a running back in your prime and then let yourself go. And I know he got back in shape and it was unfortunate with the hamstring this year and, you know, how it worked out, but it was so disappointing to hear that because I know he was such a hard worker and to hear that like the Jets were the team, of course, they gave him the money and then it didn't work out.
I loved when Ty Johnson came in because first time I've seen speed at running back by the Jets in a long time. And I really wanted to see more of Ty Johnson. And I'm still hoping, you know, we haven't had a guy that can break one. So, because defenses can come up and play on Sam, on anything else. If you know that the Jets' longest run is 15 yards, it's not hard to play defense and defend the pass as much, but you know, I would love to be able to get a running back that has a possibility of breaking one. That's good, really good, you know, pass catcher out of the backfield is the outlet and things like that. So I'm looking for that in the draft, definitely.
I would love to be able to draft a running back and then have P. Ryan and Ty Johnson and kind of have this three-headed. They're all different running backs.
Yes.
They would draft and P. Ryan's more of a zone guy, but he's got some speed and breakaway ability. Ty Johnson's a ton of speed. And then maybe a guy that can get, you know, the tough yards. And I think running back's position has changed. And I mean, obviously, you know, that's better than me, but it's changed so much in the last even 10, 15 years where it's like now speed on the outside, reliability, a tight end, guy that can catch the ball. And you need people at running back that don't need to have 400 carries anymore. It's more of, unless you're Derrick Henry, but now,
yes, that's right.
Now it's three guys getting 10 carries, 10, 15 carries. And who can break one or two runs, that's all you really need.
Yep. And that's why, of course, you know, you still come down to the trenches. You still come down to the offensive line. And if there's no holes, and if you can't do anything, and if your receivers aren't good blockers, I mean, that's why they love Mims, they said, because besides being able to catch a ball, but it's blocking ability, you know, tight end wise, I hope, you know, Chris Herndon, he looked like he started to break through again, which would be great. A poor guy went through a lot, I'm sure.
It was weird. I was talking about this with my brothers last night of how promising he looked the last eight games of 2018. Sam's rookie year, they had such a good connection. And then obviously the off the field stuff was really unfortunate. And then, you know, the broken ribs, the first game he comes back at a nice catch against the Giants and boom, he's gone the whole year. And that's tough. Yep. And then you come back this year and opening day was obviously, I mean, I don't think they were ever going to win that game, but to be down 17-10 and then fumble like that and your whole year is just a downward spiral. But yeah, there's a couple of nice catches against New England at the end of the year. He had the catch against the Chargers, I believe. But you know, I'd like to see some of these young guys take a step this year, and if they can draft well and add, I don't need them to add 15 guys. I need them to add like depth and really quality, like at least B level players that hopefully you can coach up to an A. I don't need to always, you don't always need to sign all the A level guys. Because they could cost them.
You know, we brought in, which I like Guidry, who runs a 4.29. One thing our defense need was speed. We are not, our linebackers and our even, you know, defensive line, we didn't have a lot of speed, even a corner stuff. So I'm really hoping.
I hope CJ Mosley can play even half as well as he did that first half against Buffalo, because that might have been the best player on defense I've seen in, other than Revis, in 30 years on defense. That first half against Buffalo was incredible.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm hoping, you know, that, as I said, that we do get some more speed on defense, because we really do need that. And, you know, as I said, Sanchez, remember Mark had Dustin Keller, and some, I think Dustin Keller was so underrated, and he was always there. I have to admit, you know, Mark did have a lot more people to work with, you know, whether it was Santonio or whether it was Braylon, you know, and the running backs, Thomas.
Jericho Cotri and
Love Cotchery, Brad Smith. I mean, you go through there was a great, and plus that offensive line, you know, you had Damian Woody and Fanica, Mangold and Brick.
Hopefully. I mean, that's like, in my opinion, I think those are four guys, at least. Fanica just got in the Hall of Fame, but I hope DeBrickishaw and Mangold can get in the Hall of Fame. And I don't know, it'll be tough for Damian Woody, but he's another guy who's, I mean, you look at that O-line comparatively to the last couple of years. It's like,
no, and those guys were totally amazing that we had to work with in 2009 and 10. They really were amazing. The Thomas Jones, they don't come any, again, we had some really strong locker room guys too, you know, that were leaders in the locker room as well. And like you said, Tony Richardson, great, what a great leader he was. So we really had some amazing. You had David Harris, who was quiet, but you know, just played so well. And of course, Revis was as shut down as they possibly could be.
Well, I just you know, thank you, obviously, you know, again for coming on the podcast. And you know, again, if you want to check, you know, Connie out on Twitter, she's a great follow at Connie Scouts, and you can kind of read more about her background, things like that. And yeah, no, we appreciate having you on, and hopefully we'll have you on before the season starts. We have some more exciting stuff to talk about.
Oh, great, Will. It's been a pleasure. It's a pleasure talking to you and getting to know you.
Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.